Welcome to the Regen Brands Podcast. This is a place for consumers, operators, and investors to learn about the consumer brands supporting regenerative agriculture and how they're changing the world. This is your host, Kyle, joined with my co-host, Dave C. Let's dive in.
On this episode, we have Stephanie and Blake Alexander, who are the husband and wife co-founders of Alexander Family Farm. Alexander Family Farm is supporting regenerative agriculture through their organic A2 dairy products as the first certified regenerative dairy brand in the world. In this episode, we learn about Stephanie and Blake's deep family roots as dairy farmers, their journey from conventional to regenerative production, and how they've built their own vertically integrated CPG brand from scratch. Stephanie and Blake are a joy to chat with and support. They are truly people fighting the good fight and doing things the right way. And they put so much thought into their business. It is just so evident in this conversation. Kyle and I are thrilled to have these regen pioneers join us. So let's dive in. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Regen Brands Podcast. We are so pumped today to have Blake and Stephanie Alexander with us of the Regen Dairy Pioneering Alexander Family Farm. So welcome, Blake and Stephanie. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
We chatted briefly before the call started. I've been a big consumer of Alexander Family Farms for, I think, about a year and a half now. And I basically just try to drink every product I can find. So really excited to have you two on. For those who are unfamiliar with the brand, can you just give us a really general overview of what products you make and where you can generally be found if somebody wants to find you at a grocery store?
We are Alexander Family Farm, and we are known for certified regenerative A2 organic milk. We also have yogurts, and we're known for a high 6% butterfat milk. And most of our products are found on the West Coast, but we also nationally have carton product that's a 4% whole milk and 2%, as well as some yogurts nationwide.
Nice. And when you say West Coast, is that primarily like natural channel, like natural grocers, Whole Foods, or what types of retailers are you in right now?
Yes. Whole Foods, natural grocers, like you just said, they've been great partners. Any independent, organic, natural food stores, co-ops. And of course, customers can ask for our products in there by the dairy buyer.
Yeah. So we launched 5 years ago on the West Coast. Three states here on the West, and we're primarily kind of saturated in that market on the high-end natural food stores. And then the longer shelf life products are now reaching across the country in Whole Foods and other retailers.
Mm-hmm. And y'all are doing eggs now too, right?
Yeah, the eggs have been a big part of who we are for a long time. We actually started with eggs about 16, 17 years ago. And the brand on that is called Alexander Kids. And so literally that was a way for us to raise our kids and give them a project. We've got five kids. And when the oldest two were about 11, 12, 13, they started that egg business with our help, really. And it's grown and done really well.
Love it. Love it. Well, you're giving us a little background of the taste into the family's journey. And I've heard you guys kind of talk about it on some other podcasts, and we've talked about it in person. And it's a really compelling story of both your family's, you know, histories in the dairy industry, and then just y'all's individual journey kind of through the dairy business and how you've gotten to the production methods you've gotten today. So take us through just kind of your origin story and your arc to where the brand is now.
Sure. So I grew up in this region about 100 miles from where we live today. And our oldest son and his wife now live in that my hometown of Ferndale, where my great grandfather had started the dairy about 100 years ago. And so really, you know, our kids are down there as fifth generation. And 2 weeks ago, they had their sixth generation started. So that was really exciting.
Incredible, and congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really cool. And so that's my roots are right here in Northern California on the coast, grazing milk cows literally for 100 years, whether we were conventional or organic here for the last 20 some. Stephanie is from Southern California, and we met at college a couple of days ago.
Yeah, just in
nice.
I did grow up on a dairy farm in Southern California and grew up knowing I loved cows. I love milk and love the dairy industry and prayed I'd marry a dairy farmer and got my guy.
Manifest. I love that.
What were you studying in college? Were you able to meet? Was it like in a classroom? Was it like some extracurricular events? What did that look like?
Yeah, extracurricular. Mm-hmm. Stephanie was on the volleyball team, and she drove a really fancy car. And I was a couple years older, and he was tall and good looking. And so us dairy guys would go to the volleyball games. And we heard there was a girl from the dairy industry on the volleyball team, and so that's how it all started. Right there.
Love that. You were the cream of the crop from the start, Blake, yeah. Huh?
Yeah. Well, Blake drove a car that said "Love Cows" on the license plate, so that was a great deal for me.
Wow,
love that. So you guys leave college, and then what happens?
So actually, I left college two years ahead of Stephanie. Went home, worked on the farm in Ferndale with my parents. And at that mm-hmm. point, it's a rented facility. It's not my grandfather's dairy at this point. It was my parents, the dairy I grew up on, that they had leased for about 38 years. And mm-hmm. And so I was working there and helping out and, you know, communicating long distance with Stephanie for another 2.5 years before we got married and then lived in Ferndale again, working for my parents for about 6 months. And then we migrated down to Southern California and rented a dairy facility and started a partnership with her parents for them. It was a second dairy on about a 500 cow dairy in Southern California in Chino town.
But I'll also add, when I was finishing up my senior project in college, Blake helped me and we did it on raising heifers in Ferndale and looked into Stan Parsons, which was a partner with Alan Savory. So we were already doing the on grass based stuff, the growth of grass throughout the year, the percentage each month, rotational grazing, or I think it was management intensive grazing back then.
No, rotational.
And so anyway, we already started on that conquest to learn about how to do it better in working with grass.
What piqued your interest about making that shift? Yeah, I'm curious to know that seems way ahead of the curve, at least for today's. It's still becoming popular. There's still so much runway. Why did you want to go that route?
Yeah, I'm going to fast forward a few years there and I think answer that question with the context of actually living in Southern California as we moved down there and became a dairyman in that area or region. It was really enlightening for me because I always felt that we went from two extremes. One extreme is Ferndale, where I grew up, small farms, grazing, you know, just not real intense. And of course, cows are out on their own, sink or swim. And then we moved to Southern California where it's confinement farming and we're literally on 40 acres with 500 cows. And you've got all the tools to feed. Yeah.
That's how I grew up.
And that wasn't all that intense. I mean, other farms were much larger, not acres wise, but where we had all the tools to feed the cows and group them by production and really encourage and stimulate high production. And so when I got down there, I was like, wow, these guys have all the capabilities of getting a lot of milk out of their cows. And then I realized that the 300 farms down there compared to the 100 farms back home, we were getting more milk back home. We had healthier cows and more butterfat per cow per year. And it really shocked me. I guess learned, you know, the beauty of what they were doing was, you know, the efficiency of kind of the numbers and feeding and buying cheaper feed and targeting it to the lower end cows and just learning how to target the high end cows and really take care of them. So that was very beneficial for us. And having that contrast was just a super great learning tool. So 4 years later, when we bought the ranch up north here and moved home, in a sense, we were able to kind of combine both worlds and put the efficiency mm-hmm. skills that we have in there into a grazing mm-hmm. setting where cows tend to live longer, perform better. You know, we've come full circle now with organic production. We don't have the tools in the feed barn that we used to. And so we are very content with a lot less milk per cow.
Yeah, that's really interesting, right? And I think that we, we need to see more of that for regen to scale, right? It's like the efficiencies and the scale, but also like the return to doing things the right way and organic and all those things. So it's really interesting to hear you speak to that.
So 4 years after we lived in Southern California, my hometown, we bought our ranch up here where we are today, Crescent City. And really, when we bought it, we were leaving both our dairy communities. We were going to another community that wasn't a dairy community. And I would say our parents weren't super supportive because we were young, 4 years old, you know, in their army, little kids, 2 year old and 1 year old.
And
but it was just a feeling of we were called to be here. And you see this ranch, and it was beautiful, riparian zones, and creeks, basically, and a lot of grass, a lot of pasture, and where land doesn't come for sale in Blake's hometown, this was an opportunity for us to get on our own and have our own farm that we could own. And at that same time, environmentalists were a real thing, very active, and tree huggers and stuff like that. It felt like, oh my gosh, we could be the environmentalists. Look what we have to take care of. We could be caretakers of this land. And I think kind of got into that spirit wanting to better it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
That region is really great for grazing cows. And I don't know if a lot of our listeners really know why. So can you guys explain kind of what that bioregion is like in Crescent City and why it's so great for raising, you know, dairy cows on grass?
Sure. Yeah. So we're, you know, coastal plains, if you will, where the rivers are coming out to the ocean. And we're literally about a mile from the ocean. We're only about 10 miles out of Oregon farm. And so we're extreme Northern California. And the temperatures are really cool. So I think the most extreme statistic to get through people's head is that our average summer temperature and our average winter temperature are only 11 degrees apart.
And wow. That's
11 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we're basically in the low 50s in the winter and the high 50s in the summer.
Yeah.
You know, California's in a heat wave. Yeah, California's heat wave this week. I talked to a friend of mine in the Valley, and it was 112 yesterday, 114 the day before. And we're sitting up here with, 65 to 75 on these really hot days.
Wow.
It's just literally comfortable for cool season grasses and cows and people. And it's a wonderful environment, much like a New Zealand or Ireland type setting.
And then also we get the rainfall in the wintertime. We have housing for the cows for winter to protect the land. And so we can get anywhere from 60, 80 to 120 inches. And so we're a little bit isolated when they talk about the Western drought. We do have water available to us.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And when you guys came back, you started your own deal. What was the arc from conventional, organic, regenerative? I mean, what was that whole transition like? Why did you make those decisions, and how has that played out over the years?
I would say that what first happened was we befriended a soil agronomist, John Schneider, and he taught us about soil organic matter and what we could do the soil. So that was even before we went organic. So we were starting to pay attention to soil organic matter. And then Clover Starnet, a dairy brand in California, wanted to go organic, and they were recruiting organic milk. And so we really went organic as a business decision. Then it was like, well, how do you do things organically? How do we figure that all out? So Blake and I learned about Acres USA in the Midwest, and that was really cool because the keynote speakers were doctors making a difference in people's lives and teaching them to go to the farm instead of the pharmacy. And so I became this nutrient dense foodie mom. We had five little kids at the time, and I was worried about calves. And then Blake, who's an outstanding cowman and always loved cows, he really got into soil biology and pasture grasses and was learning about New Zealand style grazing through our friend John Schneider, who was the agronomist. And really, he loved Gary Zimmer's book, The Biological Farmer, and learned so much early on. So it just was a paradigm shift for us and a focus rather than it being a business decision. It became almost like a purpose. It gave us a purposeful journey on how to do things better for the sake of better food out in the nation.
I would call out the fact that John had led us down this organic matter path was just really absolutely ideal, because that's the core of, I think, organics, and the core of regenerative certainly if you can build organic matter in your soil and just literally focus on that and pay attention to that with a compost program and a fertilizer program that doesn't do harm, that just benefits and works in harmony with nature. When you're doing that and building organic matter, and we were doing it because we wanted to irrigate less. You know, we wanted the humus and the humates to build up to hold more moisture and you know, lower our cost of production. And then, you know, what you see is that, you know, not only do you lower your cost of production, but you increase yields and you have more sustainable yields. And your fields are greener, longer for much darker green relative to the neighbors who are using commercial fertilizers, who get a big bang and then a yellow effect 2 months later.
I think that's one of the themes that we keep hearing when we interview and talk to brands like this is like that long-term play, right? It's not looking for the quick fix. It's like you're looking for the long-term, you know, health of your business and for the health of your land. And I'm curious. So at this stage in the game, you're starting to transition to produce organic products for a different brand, or at this stage, do you already have your brand active?
No, we were literally content being a normal dairy farmer where you sell truckloads of milk to somebody. That's the business model that we all had in mind or in our heads. And occasionally it was through a co-op or something. But in this case, Clover Sornetta, which is 300 miles south of here, was looking for milk. And so we're like, okay, we'll make truckloads of milk every other day. And we'll sell one to Clover Sornetta. And then we sold one to Tillamook Cheese, who was looking
for
they owned Bandon Cheese at the time, and they were wanting an organic option. And so we literally alternated truckloads for that first year. So we were totally pioneering this organic industry out here on the West Coast. And then about 2 years into that, we took the whole production model and handed it back to our hometown co-op in Ferndale, which my family had always been part of literally for the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. And that was Humboldt Creamery. And so then Humboldt Creamery used our milk to start an organic label and eventually make ice cream and some other products. And it was going really well until I would say about 10 years in, and they went through a bankruptcy that just devastated the co-op. And it was very unfortunate. I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that they were organic or organic products. It was just some internal fraud that caught everybody off guard, including the banks and the.
Wow.
That's a bummer to hear that. So I'm curious. So it sounds like that was a major event. Was that sort of the catalyst into creating your own brand, or was there a different event that triggered that action?
Yeah, great connection, Kyle. That's exactly why I brought it up.
Okay.
And I had to stop talking because it hurt so much. So we went through hell there really, really badly. And it took years to kind of catch our breath financially. And, you know, one of the things that brought us out was Organic Valley. It eventually started buying milk out here in this region, and that was very helpful. That was 3 years later. And then we had a few good years after that, I'd say 2 or 3 years. And then we were at an Expo West conference in L.A., and Stephanie was kind of pulled aside by a couple of Whole Foods folks who said, hey, we think you guys should start a brand. And in fact, we would love to help. And so that became the, that conversation as we drove home from that 14-hour trip. Wow. We talked about it, and we were under the impression, oh, no, we got a good thing going. You know, we had a failure with the co-op. Let's just ride this thing out. And then we realized, you know, that, hey, our kids aren't going to grab this ball and run with it. We're not that old yet. Let's just We came home and talked to the kids about this brand concept, and we didn't see any major pushback because we were really telling them what we wanted to do, and you know they were going to come along for the ride, willing or not, and they were all in, and it was wonderful. So they were helpful. So that was about 6-7 years ago, and we literally launched 5 years ago, September 17th, up in. Seattle, Washington.
With Whole Foods and connections there. And then, and part of it was prior to us deciding to do our own brand, we had already gone to our creameries that we sell to locally and really pushing the A2 story. A2, the identical milk and dairy, is real. And we read the science. We read the book, The Devil's in the Milk by Dr. Keith Woodford out of New Zealand. Our two daughters had gone to Lincoln University in New Zealand and got to know their program and saw New Zealand studies and where A2 Milk Corp had started. And so we were following that. We actually went to A2 Milk Corp to see if they would do an organic option, and they weren't interested. So then us wanting to do the brand was really a passion to get the better milk out in the marketplace. And then as we started hearing from customers that tried our milk and stuff, especially kids with autism that really can't do dairy, they can do A2. And we really were excited about what we were seeing when we first launched.
Yeah. One of the big motivators that I think y'all would just love to understand is we were asked, because of our egg brand, to speak at a food IT, so integrated technology at Stanford University. Our son Christian was going to go because he was kind of our chicken guru who had studied in college. and so he was busy like with an APA conference or someplace. And so this was about 7-8 years ago. So I drove down. It was 500 miles. And I'm thinking I've got to, you know, talk to this crowd at Stanford. Of course, I'm just a farmer from, you know, nowhere. And the subject was, why $10 eggs? And so I drove all the way down there for this question, you know, why is this little brand able to sell their eggs for $10 a dozen? You know, this is 7-8 years ago. And so I got there, and then basically I'm on a panel, I'm giving the talk, and I said, consumers have the right to spend more to get extra, or to spend extra to get more, however you want to look at it. And so we have always tried to embrace, you know, nutrition first, which starts in the soil, and literally make the best quality products available for consumers that want the best, that want to spend more because they believe, you know, that it's good for them or good for their kids. And so that's where we kind of always had that mindset. And so as Stephanie's talking about this A2 knowledge that we learned about, and it's like, we can't get a organic company or the A2 company to launch an A2 organic version. It's like, well, shoot, let's just ourselves, you know, eventually that's what we fought it for a few years, but then that's really where we got. We wanted to have the sustainability coming to our family farm of a co-op or a buyer of milk that wouldn't go broke, that wouldn't go away, you know, would just be there. And so, you know, for us, this was a sustainability move financially to add, you know, longevity to our farm, and I think ultimately give us a real purpose to, you know, to spend the extra time, effort, and money on the soil and with our cattle and products, so that, you know, we could provide that service of paying more to get extra to all consumers that we could possibly reach.
Yeah. And then as our friends Whole Foods said, we check many boxes. They had been to our farm several times. Program. And because dairy people would send them to our farm of what we were doing, we were representative for these milk brands we were selling to. And with the ocean right here, the riparian zones, the creeks, the waterways that are just beautiful now that we've really concentrated on, and the bald eagle nest on the corner of our ranch, or the Roosevelt elk, or being a part of an endangered species recovery program, all that stuff changed. Different boxes, and many people have left dairy over the years, whether they couldn't digest it, where they didn't like the social aspect or the animal humane or whatever their reasons. We had so many reasons to bring people back to dairy, and that's what gave these Whole Foods buyers confidence to come help us and then come work for us to launch our brand.
Yeah, love that.
That's so incredible. Oh, Anthony, go ahead.
So two follow-up questions to that. One, for the uneducated person, Stephanie, can you explain exactly what A2 Dairy is and what that means, right? If I've never heard of A2 Dairy, explain that for me. And then two, I would love to see y'all do like a three-phase contrast between conventional dairy, organic dairy, like, because most is still probably CAFO dairy, right? And then regen organic. And then really why you guys are so different for all those reasons you just said, Stephanie. So long two questions, but would love to have you speak to both of those things.
Sure. I'll talk about the A2 first. A2 is the beta casein in milk, the protein. Historically, all milk was A2, mammal milk is A2, breast milk is A2. If you could have breast milk when you were being raised, you could drink our milk.
And you weren't lactose intolerant.
Exactly. So a lot of people go right from dairy thinking they're lactose intolerant. However, when they drink ours, they can digest it and not have a problem. So really, they're sensitive to the protein, not the lactose. What happens is when people drink regular dairy, you got this amino acid chain that's 209 links long, and there's a portion of it where they call it the beta casein morphine 7, 7 links that don't break apart. There's a histidine where there should be a proline. So you drink the milk. The first thing you notice in other people's milk, other dairies, is that it's kind of phlegmy in your mouth. And we think that's your body trying to expel that foreign protein right away. Then when you drink our milk, it's more refreshing. You go in to digest it. Your body doesn't digest that protein because it's not natural. And therefore, the lactose in your body ferments. And that's where you get the lactose intolerance symptoms. Then now you have this foreign protein that grows into your system. And you go to the doctor because you're dealing with autoimmune disease. And they say, well, get off dairy, get off gluten. Gluten's a protein as well. And so they do much better. But they want milk again. So they drink our milk and their autoimmune disease disappears, or they just don't have it. They don't have a problem. So it's just really important that if you're drinking dairy, if you're feeding your children, even infant formula, that it's from A2 dairy, the digestible natural occurring. And that mutation, they believe, happened 1,000 years ago. You know, we want to blame it on modern milk, but it's not modern milk. It might be the straw that's breaking the camel's back in a sense of all the other processed foods that are out there, then therefore you're sensitive to the A2. Whereas when we were growing up, we never heard of lactose intolerant from anybody. Everybody drank milk. But there's so many stressors in our food system today that you really have to be careful what you're eating and drinking. And so now we can be an anti-stressor with the dairy that we provide with the A2 organic milk.
You literally just said my story. I had an autoimmune disease. I was off dairy for a while, and now I drink your milk and I consume Alex ice cream, which has your milk in it daily, weekly, with no problem. It's awesome. It's amazing. That's
great. We hear that all the time, Anthony, and it's obviously real. I would say that 90% of the folks that think they're lactose intolerant are probably having issues with the protein in dairy, and A2 is a solution for them. And so we'll certainly encourage them to give it a try.
Absolutely. Is it a different cow? Like, how do you screen? How do you screen for A2 milk? Like, how do you manage that as a cow?
It's really rather simple. We pull a DNA sample. So it's a hair follicle out of the big hair in their tail, and we put it in an envelope and we send it to New Zealand back in the 10 years ago, that's how we were doing it or so. And I guess 12 or 13 years ago, New Zealand had the only lab there at Lincoln University or wherever it was that could differentiate between, telling us whether the cows had the mutated gene, which is the A1, or they were, natural A2. And it's as simple as they got, a gene from each of their parents. And so when we started labeling our milk, we were under some restrictions and patents that we couldn't break. So we called it A2 dairy. And A2 means that they got one from each parent. And it just makes it simpler. When the lab results come back that, cow number 306 is A2. So that's where all that comes from. It's that simple, and it makes it a little easier to tell the story. And now we have a couple labs here in the United States, but we're still spending $20 to $25 a cow or per animal to do that testing. And we have tested a lot of cattle in the last 13 years.
I would imagine.
Yeah. I believe it. I want to share my dairy story real quick, because I left dairy for entirely different reasons. I was worried about the environmental impact of raising cattle in general. And this is just my own, arc of learning about food systems, and assumed that all dairy, including organic, was like a CAFO type system and was detrimental to the environment. So I stopped consuming dairy for, I think, 2 or 3 years, and then started to learn more about regenerative agriculture. And then I found, you know, Alexander Farms being a regenerative dairy. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can drink milk and know that not only am I not doing harm, but I'm doing something good for the environment. Mm-hmm. And that's what brought me back to dairy. And I will say, like, I've never really had like the A1 intolerance that doesn't affect me at all, but I feel fantastic when I drink Alexander Farms. So, you know, a little bit of a different, you know, reason for coming back to Alexander Farms, but I think it's super relevant today because a lot of consumers are really conscious about trying to reduce their impact. And with mm-hmm. dairy and all animal-based products right now, there's this huge paradigm shift of like people are trying to push plant-based is good no matter what. And I think it's great when brands like you exist and tell the story of like, no, we can do dairy in a positive way and steward this land and make a really mm-hmm. positive impact. So just kudos to you guys for taking that charge forward in the dairy industry.
Yeah. Thanks, Kyle. That's, I think, a perfect segue into the answer of Anthony's second mm-hmm. question a bit ago. You know, how did we get from conventional to organic to regenerative? And, you know, we literally started out at university learning about high yield production agriculture, like everybody else in the United States back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd say here in the U.S., we were really good at, you know, making cheap food, which is what people wanted. They wanted cheap, fast food. And you know, agriculture responded to that. Farmers responded in a big way. And, you know, through the use of, you know, chemicals and pesticides and fertilizers. And so, you know, kind of no regard to the soil. The soil was just the substance that held them. And we talked about nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus, and we supplemented. And then we started supplementing with a little of the micros. And so here we are, you know, during that time, we're basically growing grass with a lot less intensity. And, you know, as we looked at the conventional world, you know, gosh, there was a time I read a book called Saving the Planet with Pesticides and Plastics. I think Dennis Avery wrote that. And I saw him at a Monsanto, you know, convention in San Diego. And I fell for that crap. Mm. How high yield production agriculture, that's going to feed the world. And so I literally read his book, you know, wondering, mm-hmm. is it truth or is it, you know, is there a better way or whatever? Mm-hmm. I would compare that book now to the Bible. And say God has a perfect plan. God gave us the you know, the nutrition and the microbiology in the soil. And if we farm with Mother Nature or God or our Creator in mind, you know, that's how we're going to feed the world. And so organic came along, like Stephanie mentioned, really out of it was more of a financial decision, and we're not ashamed to say that we were looking for niche marketing. I remember coming home from a trip up where we had toured some dairy farms in northern Oregon, and we're driving home. Kids are all asleep, and I'm sitting here thinking, wow, we just visited 6 farms in Tillamook, and 3 of them wanted to sell us their farm because they heard we were from California. And wow. It's like, what a sad state, right?
Yeah.
So why are these farmers, conventional farmers, shipping to a really good market that get paid a little extra? They'll never go organic because they don't need to. They already have access to a better market. And yet, why are they wanting to sell their farm? Well, they've lost their motivation. They've lost something. And so as I'm driving home and we're talking and thinking, it's like, what are we going to do to keep our farm viable? So these kids are going to grow up. They're going to meet their spouse. They're going to get educated. And then they're going to make an adult decision. You know, do they want to return to the farm or do they want to go out in the real world? And we just wanted to give them a better option so that that decision to come home was an easier, smarter decision, not a sacrifice to come out, you know, help out mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And so that was really our motivation, I think, behind going organic and chasing that niche market. And then once we got into it, we just literally learned that, you know, focusing on organic matter, which we were already doing, makes total sense. And now, you know, I started learning more about the biology through the biological farmer, Gary Zimmer. And, you know, it was just awesome. And so I think all that has led to being open-minded and curious and wondering. And so, 4 or 5 years ago when we're again at Expo West in LA, our daughter Vanessa was with us, and there were some regen conversations happening, and we said, you need to go, you know, learn about that, pay attention, and get us involved. And I know I went to one of those with her, and a year later she was on the panel for the ROC certification group, Regenerative Organic Alliance. And so we became a pilot farm for two different groups, and participated in the process of helping them establish rules and understandings, and of course that data on the ground. And and so when we were launching our extended shelf life milk in the cartons nationwide with Whole Foods 2 years ago, they said, well, you guys say you're regenerative. Do you have a certificate or anything that we could, you know, kind of utilize for marketing? And we're like, no, we don't, but we are. And so we went back to both the savory group with EOV and the rock group and said, you know, we need a certificate. We need something by January. And so they both got us something. And it's like, boom, we were their very first certified farm for both groups. Wow. It's not set out. It's because Whole Foods asked for it. And we happened to be launching a product that week or that month. And so, yeah, that's how that came to be. And it was really a cool thing. And so, yeah, we've got that title and no one can take that away. And so now we're trying to honor that and be respectful of the kind of the privilege and, be advocates for the story.
And I also add, you know, through our, when we're traveling, we're in a car often and we live, we have to drive to places where we go. And then we listen to a lot of podcasts, and our podcasts are focused on nutrition and and listen to other farmers also that are in the same, you know, field or learning and teaching about regenerative or soil health or what to eat to be healthier and ancestral eating kind of stuff. And so that's very motivating as a farmer to hear that and be doing it and being part of the solution. And you mentioned the conventional world and dairy and then organic and then where we are, you know, we certainly, you know, just told about that. But in the what my greatest fear about the conventional products that are out there is the exposure to glyphosates and, and the link, the healthcare system with the glyphosates and all the gluten problems people having and the autoimmune disease. You know, that's one aspect of it. With the organics, we're all pushing for stricter organic rules that cows are out truly grazing and eating grass. And we're gifted in an area where we can almost to an unfair advantage that we can graze so much. Well, then that makes milk so much better. And also that we raise all our animals organically from the start. And we're excited that some of the rules have even gotten stricter in the last year with some new regulations. But we want to keep on the forefront of doing it best for what the consumer can be drinking in a glass of milk or eating in an egg or yogurt or any of our products.
I'm curious if you could summarize three different topics for the same, like conventional, organic, and regenerative dairy operation. So like from a conventional perspective, what are they eating? Where do they spend their time? And actually maybe just those two things. What are they eating? Where do they spend their time? And if you can go by, you know, again, conventional, organic, and regenerative, how do those three things differ?
Okay. And you're talking about the cows and what they're eating, right?
Yeah. not the humans, but I think that you can answer for the humans too.
I think it was going in a different direction there, but yeah. So yeah, conventional dairy farming and you know, we have a lot of friends in that world
and relatives
and neighbors. Right. And so they typically, conventional herds are confined, like I was mentioning earlier, like our past where when we were in Chino in Southern California and cows live in a corral or now freestall barns where there's good shade and a spot to really a comfortable spot to lay down. And I think the dairy industry has done a wonderful job pampering and taking great care of those kind of cattle. It's from the cow's point of view, what are they eating? Typically, a lot of corn silage is the bulk, alfalfa hay, especially in the West, and soybeans and corn. And so soybean is the protein piece, corn is the carbohydrate. And then a whole lot of other things that are, you know, microly added. And you know, these guys are getting a lot of milk per cow now, like twice as much as we get. So, you know, I'm not here to say that we're better because they're obviously outperforming us. However, the cows, from the cow's point of view, you know, they're in high gear all the time. It's like a car doing 90 or 100 miles an hour. And so when you know, something goes wrong, it's a pretty big crash, right, for that individual cow. And she's done and she's out of the system.
And where's the cow spending its time? Is it just in that shaded paddock area that you had mentioned, or do they have the ability to walk around? If so, what does that look like?
Yeah, they're in groups of a few hundred head. I don't know, and they live usually in a corral that may have a roof over part of it or the whole thing, and then that would be called a barn or a freestall barn, and you know, they can come and go, and freestall is these little bedded areas where they individually lay down and get up at will and then go eat, and there's always feed at the manger, and so they have a fairly pampered life, if you will. It's just got a lot of concrete and a lot of neighbors and it's a pretty tight space. However, we certainly can't say that they're being harmed by that, because their performance is telling us that they're healthy and happy. And so now let's jump into organic. And the first thing about organic that we learned 25 years ago was, well, you got to graze. And then eventually that turned into 30% of their diet for 120 days, I believe. And so, yeah, we have to graze. Well, we want to graze because that was, you know, that's how we've been doing it here for 100 years. And so grazing isn't a sacrifice from my point of view when it comes to trying to grow grass organically and send cows out to get it. We know how to do that at a pretty good scale or pretty good pace. And so that our cows are eating fresh green grass 300 days a year, roughly, twice a day, most of that period. And that grass is made up of a lot of ryegrass, Italian ryegrass from Italy, a lot of New Zealand type grasses, and then New Zealand white clover and red clover and plantain and chicory and a lot of other things. So those are the primary species. But, you know, there's another 40 or 50 species, including all the weeds that we grow in our neighborhood, that they eat as well. And through the use of rotational grazing and I say simple management, we let those feeds get about 12 to 18 inches tall. And then we send in a big group of cows and don't give them a whole lot of space. So they eat it all down. And that's kind of competitive eating for a few hours. And they just clean the field up, including the weeds as well. And they pee and poop where they're supposed to. And it's just all part of the natural cycle. And then they really don't return to that space for another 40 or 50 days. You know, depending on the season, it'll even get shorter. And it's just a lot of fun. That's what we do. We manage our land that way. And so if you were to look at our fields, they're broke up into these 5 to 10 acre paddocks with a watering trough or two out in the field. And we can through using polywire, we can give the cows 3 or 4 or 5 feedings in that one field, and it's basically fresh grass every 12 hours. Then the cows return to the barn every 12 hours because they've got to report to work, and they bring a bunch of milk. And we will sometimes supplement and feed some grain or grain and hay and silage, which is grass haylage, on the manger. When the pastures are kind of petering out this time of year, we're getting close to fall, the days are shorter, the grass isn't growing at the same pace. So we kind of have to spread that out and supplement it more. You know, our farms now are 100% grass fed, where we're moving towards no grain at all. And that's our green label products. And we really like that model. We've got the right genetics now to do that efficiently. So we've got great cows that can graze and literally take great care of themselves and stay healthy and get pregnant when they're supposed to and stay in the herd for a long time and give us enough milk to make the whole thing make sense financially.
And I love Blake, that Blake mentioned the genetics, because in searching for the right genetics for our type of daring, we went out of our country and New Zealand, and then more recently Germany. And we're getting these genetics that are a little bit more old fashioned, and they are higher percent butterfat, higher percent protein. And so you can taste the difference, not only because the cows are mainly eating grass, but also because of these genetics, the way milk really used to taste. I love it when I give a sample of milk and somebody's older from a foreign country, and they'll tell me, wow, that's the milk I grew up on in Yugoslavia, my parents' farm, and just those stories. And we know our milk tastes amazing, and there's many facets to it, but I think a lot of it is our composite breeding that we've done and focused on grass-based genetics.
Yeah, I would say it like this as well. Not only does our dairy look different than a confinement farm because our cows are out grazing, but our cows look extremely different than the cows that live at the conventional dairies. We literally breeding cows that look a lot different. They have white faces. They come in multiple colors. The breed that we really love is called Fleck V from Germany. And they're actually bred dual purpose for meat and milk at the same time. And so that's why they're able to, you know, take great care of themselves on these high forage diets.
Wow. That's incredible. And I want to summarize real quick. So, and correct me if I'm wrong. In conventional dairy, there are animals that are in, call it high density areas, unable to graze. They produce a lot of milk. They're very high production animals, but they don't necessarily have to like naturally express themselves and do what cows do grazing. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. All the feed is brought to them.
And a lot of feed might be GMO products. They might be sprayed with things. They are exposed to glyphosate, things that I don't want to be a part of.
Totally. So that's conventional. Organic, there is, I think you said 30% of the diet has to be grazed over the course of 120 days. Is that correct?
Yes.
So there's a little bit of grazing, but they're also still fed organic certified, no glyphosate, hopefully, feed. Yes. And not quite as much feed. Pasture time.
Right. And every feedstuff that we feed them, whether it might be corn and soybean or hay, has to be grown on our certified organic ground or bought from a certified organic, producer.
Got it.
And let me also be clear. So that was the minimum for grass. We're achieving about 50% of our cow's diet for 365 days on grass. Mm-hmm. So we're blowing the minimum out by four times, I'd say at least. Mm-hmm. And that's because we lean on grass. So we have a little pasture promise to our consumers that we're going to lean on grass as hard as we can. And we do that. And we're just trying to get better and better at growing healthier, more vigorous grasses and pastures. And then, of course, don't tear them up when it's raining 5 inches in one day.
So
we have to be careful.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a loading story there. Like it's happened before.
Yeah, it happens. It happens every year somewhere. And it's just a simple, it's an extra 3 hours that they stayed in the field and we should have pulled them out earlier.
Right. Okay. Well, I really appreciate the kind of summary of, these are the differences between these three different types of dairy. We've done a deep dive into regenerative practices and sort of like how you guys do what you do. I'm curious from like a commercial and like a sales traction, you mentioned you launched the brand 5 years ago. What did selling regenerative A2 dairy look like 5 years ago? And how does it look today? And what do you see like the future of that sort of subset within dairy? What do you think that's going to look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, well, 3 or 5 years ago, it didn't exist. There was no A2 options.
Right.
Really. I mean, maybe a couple small farms in Pennsylvania or something were selling milk to their neighbors. That was A2. I don't know that for sure, but I'm guessing that was a possibility. But there was no brand out there and no organic brand at all. And so, we just jumped in and, decided to be the first. And so we spent the first 3 years telling our consumers what A2 meant and what A2 meant.
And still do.
Just educating folks, both buyers, retailers, and consumers. And we didn't have a budget to do it. So we spent a lot of family time doing demos in stores and just one-on-ones and getting people to taste it. And then I'd say our product speaks for itself. All you have to do is taste our eggs or taste our milk, and you're generally going to be hooked. And so we don't need to tell you the best, that it's the best. The way we communicate that is the price tells you it's the best. And so some people want the best, they try it. And I think most return. In the last 2 years, it's been easier to tell our story, but the story always starts with regenerative first. So for some reason, this word that came along to describe, the system, I'd say God's system in managing and managing the earth or managing soil and sequestering carbon and doing the right thing at every turn, is it's just an easier story to tell. Retailers, brands, everybody jumped on that bandwagon. We hope that they're serious about it, and we're certainly doing our part to tell the story. And consumers seem to relate to it. And there is a lot of chatter about it, and some interpretations that I think need to be fleshed out still. And so we try to say certified regenerative whenever we can, because we are. And there's, at some point, there's going to be a huge difference between the certified group and the rest of the field.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we need pioneers like y'all that have set the bar so high to really establish that baseline of accountability. And so, I don't think the average consumer will ever understand how much work and effort and fortitude it took for you guys to basically create the brand, create the first regenerative organic A2 products, go tell that story, beat that drum and try to run a profitable business all while doing all that. And so, as someone that has made a career now of supporting regenerative agriculture, I can't thank you guys enough, because it lays the foundation for people like us that can hopefully help you in some way or help tell the story or whatever that may be.
Well, we appreciate it. Profitability is key.
Yeah.
So
if you want to stay in business, it's kind of important.
We want to stay in business.
Yeah, thanks. And it is crazy hard. It's hard to pay the bills today. And so we're still fighting through the startup phase of everything we do, because we just keep doing new stuff all the time. And, most of that's my fault for being too aggressive. We're just literally trying to do the right thing here.
It's important to acknowledge that, you've got a super premium product. You mentioned the price is high. But it's not because you're trying to line your pockets and make a ton of money. You're just trying to maintain a level of probably razor thin margins and some level of profitability. And really all of that premium that people are paying is going into your operation. And I think it's really important to call that out, because, whenever there's a new brand coming up premium price, I'll look at it. And I've worked in natural foods for 10 years. And I'll say, okay, is this truly a premium product? Is there something premium about their supply chain or the way this food is being grown that demands this premium price? Or is this just really slick branding and they're trying to make some money? So I think it's really important to acknowledge, like you said, you're just trying to maintain a profitable business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And that is absolutely the truth. And we're just right on the edge of profit right now we got to get the farm healthier so that, we can keep moving forward with the whole project. And it does feel good.
Yeah. We truly bet the farm. We used our equity in our farm, our land, to launch the brand. And so we're walking a thin rope, but it's exciting to see the growth in the brand and get the EBITDA positive we see and the sales that hockey putt is real.
Yeah.
Sales are increasing. But now we need to get the farm healthy and talk about, how to do that.
This is your most cliche phrase in the book is you bet the farm.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you took us right to that, something we want to cover, and you guys don't have to give us exact details, but I'm curious to educate the audience on, when you have a farming operation and then you have a brand and then you have other entities, and there's probably a mixture of debt, equity, grants, loans, there's all kinds of financial mechanisms kind of going on there. So just help the audience understand how much risk you're taking on and maybe just what that looks like high level from a financial perspective.
Yes. So we have the dairy farm, and the dairy farm produces mm-hmm. milk, and then we have an egg farm that produces eggs. We sold those products to a brand to sell, and that brand mm-hmm. was starting up. And therefore, the brand didn't pay back the farms for goods. So we kept throwing, sending milk to a buyer that didn't pay us. But for the sake of the brand, and we also did some real estate appraisals and new loans on equity and land and put that into the brand too. So it's definitely has the farm suffering and lenders, our land lenders and cow lenders nervous, but it's exciting to see the brand and now say, oh, we have this brand that's doing so well, but this dairy and egg business needs to get paid to bring itself back, and that's the kind of the global look of what we're dealing with. Would you say it differently?
Yeah, I would just add that, we are large. We've got thousands of cows on five farms and a lot of land, 9,000 acres. We own most of it. And so it's very capital intensive and a lot of dollars involved. When Stephanie says the brand didn't pay us for milk, that's $5-7 million worth of product that we haven't been paid for. It's a big stress on the farm, and so the numbers are large. And I think that it's also important to say that because of our stubbornness or our intelligence
probably a combination of
a little bit of both.
We didn't want to bring in venture capital, and we didn't want equity partners on the brand. And we're not building a brand so we can sell it. We're not building a brand to build our egos. We simply are doing a brand as a necessary component to sell our milk off the farm. The farm that makes A2 regenerative organic milk like nobody else. And so it's literally, I believe, the best milk in the country that you can find on the shelf. That's we couldn't get another group to do it, to bring it to market. But we did it ourselves. And we're trying to make that work.
Also, we live in one of the poorest counties in California, if not the poorest still. And it was like that when we moved here 30 years ago. And when I said in the beginning of our talk, we were called to be here. We're all about rural revival. We're about our community. We had 190 kids adopt a calf for our Little Bucket Calf program we do every summer, and we've done for 24 years. We educate the public where food comes from. I hope that we could do so well for our brand that we could sell our milk locally cheaper. We maybe don't sell cheaper, but all of the milk that's close to sell by date comes back and goes to our local food bank. So our milk is in the food, the mouths of people who really need it in our rural community that suffers with economic issues in our community. And so we're part of that charge. We love hearing Will Harris talk about his rural revival, and we're right there with him, knowing that that's so purposeful for a rural community to have those key businesses that really want to give back in the community. And that's so important to us and all rural communities that are kind of dwindling. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I love that. So you're taking us there to our kind of closing topic, which is basically, Kyle and I wanted to start this podcast for lots of reasons, but one of those reasons is we're all trying to figure out how do we scale this thing, right? How does regenerative agriculture get more market share? How does it go mainstream? Whatever kind of word or terminology you want to use. And so the final question that we ask everyone is really, how can we get regen brands to have 50% market share by 2050? What needs to happen to make that happen?
Yeah, I think that's a very worthy goal, I've been fortunate to be involved with California Farm Bureau and had the opportunity to speak at three of the American Farm Bureau conferences farmer groups, so 7,000 people attend those things, and perhaps the last subject I chose was honor soil like you would your grandchild. And, and really what I'm saying there is the soil is part of us. It's part of who we are. And it's what we leave for the next generation. So I think that as farmers become more aware, and the reason I bring up the Farm Bureau thing is because there's these conventional farmers in the audience that come up and say, wow, I hadn't thought of it like that. I didn't know that, fertilizers were negative. I didn't know they were hurting my grandchildren. I didn't know that it was, you know, affecting the farm. I didn't know that it was a diminishing return. And so I think the diminishing return of NPK going into the soil and getting less every year and needing more every year is just so incredibly obvious now that farmers can't help but pay attention. And so, yeah, we're leaning in that direction. I think it's really cool that what I always tell these conventional farmers is pay attention to some of these regenerative principles. You don't have to go organic. I'm not asking you to switch churches and religions all at the same time. Just some of these religious principles that I believe truly are biblical, by the way, and paying attention to the regenerative principles and adopting some of those, and then maybe getting your hay and your soybeans and your corn grown that direction is absolutely going to benefit the farmer on the other end that's growing them, as well as your cattle and your consumers. And so I think it's a natural evolution. We just got to get our ego set aside and our head straight. So to me, it's common sense that that's where we're going.
Mm. I think the theme that struck me most in what you just said is the connectivity between humans and what they're consuming, is that soil is a part of us. And that is both literal and figurative, right? Because, you know, the soil that your cattle is eating, you know, they use that nutrients to create milk that we then consume. And like, you know, if we're drinking high protein milk, that builds our muscles and does a number of other things in our body that literally become part of who we are. So to think about food in that way, instead of just fuel that goes in and out, but it actually like is what composes your body, I think is an educational shift that we can make to try to get people more interested in how their food is being grown and processed. Mm-hmm. So I just really, that hit me home, like in a really positive way. I wanted to share that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just add to it. It's about nutrient density. It's not just empty calories and calories going and flowing everybody because they ate at McDonald's. It's about the nutrition truly builds their body in a way where they can think better. They can think more clearly. They need animal fats to literally feed their brain, the vitamin B there or whatever it needs to think more clearly. And so I would really encourage people to question their diet and be part of this solution and shift gears.
Mm-hmm. And I heard out of there, Blake, profitability mentioned a couple of times. And when I think about that, it's how do we create these systems where it's the most profitable financially? Yes, because we need that for farmer adoption, but also, ecologically and biologically when we talk about human health. Like those are the three things, triple bottom line or whatever catchphrase you want to use for them. But it's about how do we create a more profitable system across those three lanes? And that's the answer.
Yeah, it truly is. I spent 21 years on a regional land trust board of directors, and we had to define sustainability 20 some years ago. And we ultimately came up with it. It boiled down to, well, it has to be profitable. If a farm or a ranch or a landmass isn't profitable, it's not sustainable. And we can't just call it a park, a national or state park, and pretend that that's, really benefiting society because it's not feeding anybody, right? And so we all have, and we have this land and we have the earth, and Mother Earth has been given to us to steward, and we need to step up as responsible stewards of that. It's truly that simple.
Yeah, and also the on a national scale, our farm bill needs to be tied to our healthcare bill.
And 100%.
Go, yes. Please, yes, dive into this. This is such an important topic. Please, go there.
Have you read Food Fix by Mark Hyman?
No.
Nope.
Okay, highly, highly recommend that book. He talks a lot about how our government operates in silos and that, food and ag can work against themselves and, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole. Incredible book. And it touches on that exact sentiment very well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank y'all so much. I think that's a perfect way to wrap up. Stephanie, share with the listeners, like website, Instagram, any of that stuff. Just where can they find y'all if they want to learn more and connect with y'all?
We're alexanderfamilyfarm.com. Also, that's our handle for Instagram and Facebook. And then Blake and I are both on LinkedIn, as well as you can follow our brand, Alexandria Family Farm, on LinkedIn as well.
And Alexander is spelled R-E on the end. It's a little backwards there. My dad was Portuguese, and that's how we did it.
Perfect. I was just going to say the same thing. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you all so much. We really appreciate you guys and just appreciate all the work you've done.
Thank you. And thanks. Thanks for the work you guys are doing. Yes. We appreciate that. And I guess we will be seeing you shortly in a few weeks.
Yeah, very soon.
Okay.
Thanks, y'all. Care.
Thanks, guys.
For show notes and more information on our guests and what we discuss on the show, check out our website, regen-brands.com. That is regen-brands.com. You can also check out our YouTube channel, Regen Brands Podcast, for all of our episodes with both video and audio. The best way to support our work is to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to future episodes. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Regen Brands Podcast, brought to you by the Regen Coalition and Outlaw Ventures. We hope you learned something new in this episode and it empowers you to use your voice, your time, and your dollars to help us build a better and more regenerative food system. Love you guys.